The labor movement's big moment.
It's Recall Election Day in Wisconsin.
From APM, American Public Media in New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. It's Tuesday, June 5th.
Coming up, an emergency conference call to deal with the euro crisis.
A new warning for one of the great wonders of the world.
And we'll visit a place where a car costs more than a house.
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Today's the day of that long-awaited vote on whether to recall Wisconsin's Republican Governor Scott Walker. It's been more than a year since Walker tried to weaken public employee unions in the state, angering many voters who worked to force him out of office. Aaron Toner of station WUWM in Milwaukee checked in with some Wisconsinites ahead of the election.
28-year-old Rosemary Walser makes $29,000 a year teaching music at a state university. That makes her one of the public workers who lost their collective bargaining rights last year and began paying more for health insurance. She says she wants Scott Walker recalled because he pitted public workers against the private sector and slashed funding for education and health care programs.
It just seems to fly in the face of everything that Wisconsin really represents as far as labor and as far as, you know, the general public and the happiness and health of the general public.
Walser says the Republican governor points to a falling unemployment rate in Wisconsin, but many of her friends and family are still struggling.
When you see so many people that are trying their best to get a job or trying their best to get health care, to even get their teeth cleaned, you know, without paying out the nose, it's very hard and very sad.
Walser lives in Milwaukee, Wisconsin's poorest city. Elm Grove, a village 10 miles away, is one of the state's wealthiest communities. That's where I found Neil Palmer. He's 62 and owns a consulting firm.
We had a state that was working its way to catching up with Illinois or other states and being, you know, bankrupt if you were in private industry.
Palmer believes Walker did the right thing by cutting spending on government employees and pushing for tax breaks that benefit business.
Has he created jobs? Absolutely. Has he created an atmosphere that will create more? Yes. By controlling our state budget and working for reforms, we will be in a much better shape than anybody else to create jobs.
Scott Walker is far from fulfilling his promise to create 250,000 new private sector jobs. The Democrat in today's recall election is Tom Barrett, the mayor of Milwaukee. Barrett's been hammering Walker on his jobs record and an investigation into alleged criminal activity among the governor's former aides and associates. In Milwaukee, I'm Aaron Toner for Marketplace.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner was on an emergency conference call this morning with his counterparts from the world's seven leading industrialized nations. The topic of discussion, new fears about the European debt crisis and a global economic slowdown. The BBC's Steve Evans joins us now from Berlin with more. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Steve, what are the expectations for this big G7 phone meeting today?
I think the expectation is that the North Americans, the Canadians and the US will say to Europe, look, this is serious and you need to be doing more. All the signs are from Washington that they are not happy with the pace at which events seem to be unfolding and running away from the authorities, but also unhappy at European attempts to get a grip on this thing. These things are not normally made public, but this time people are saying there's a phone meeting today, there's a conference call today, and that's because the Canadians in particular, they want to let the Europeans know that things need to be sorted out.
And Steve, is there any chance that there's going to be more stimulus that comes out of this meeting?
No, I don't think so. They are preparing ground. There's no sense at all in Berlin that the German government is moving towards stimulus. What you might get is a belief in Berlin that long-term structures need to be changed. There needs to be more coordination between the countries of Europe in their fiscal policy, their banking regulation, that kind of thing. And when that happens, then maybe more money can be pooled. But we are talking years away. Renegotiating treaties is not something you do in 1 year or even two.
The BBC's Steve Evans joining us from Berlin. Thank you so much, Steve.
You're welcome.
Well, for some analysis now, let's bring in Julie Neiman of Smith, Moore & Company. She's with us, as always, from St. Louis. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
Well, Spain's Treasury Minister said today that the country is starting to lose access to international credit markets, which is a pretty significant sign that the crisis there is getting worse. What are you expecting from this phone meeting today?
Well, there was a big gulp in New York this morning, and I think Tim Geithner probably said something like, "Will somebody please think of something? We're watching a slow-motion train wreck." First, you've got to calm the markets, the stock market and the credit markets. The credit markets, they're fearing a bank panic in Europe. Spain and Portugal are already headed all the way down, and it looks like a replay of the 2008 panic. Stocks, Club Med stocks, have already fallen about 50%. That's spreading to the rest of Europe. Japan's at a 28-year low. We're in a 10% correction. It's not a bear market, but it's definitely a correction. But economic activity worldwide is slowing, so that's what they're talking about.
Well, Julie, there's been a new call here in this country, most recently from President Obama's former top economist, Larry Summers, for more stimulus. Do you think that that's possible, and would it help?
He's got an innovative approach to it, and his thought is interest rates are near zero right now. This is time for governments to borrow to the hilt and for corporations, because you're never going to get lower interest rates. Put it to work on projects that will make countries and companies grow. In the U.S., that would be rebuilding our seaports, bridges, highways, airports. No pork barrel projects like Alaska Bridges to Nowhere, no new post offices in Okmulgee Swamp. What you're really doing is putting it together with very productive ends. Do we have the fundamental will to do it, though?
Julie Niemann, analyst with Smith Moore and Company. Thanks as always.
You bet.
America these days is the land of natural gas. Now there's word ExxonMobil has an idea about what it wants to do with some of that glut, export it to Europe and Asia. Exxon CEO believes gas could surpass demand for coal worldwide by the year 2025. Marketplace's David Gura joins us from Washington with the story. David, why is Exxon considering this?
Well, things have changed over the last few years pretty radically, as a matter of fact. For a long time, the U.S. was a country that imported a lot of natural gas. And I should say we use natural gas for electricity, for cooking and heating, for transportation. But now companies like ExxonMobil, they've gotten a lot better, as you said, at extracting natural gas here in North America from what are called unconventional sources or controversial sources like shale gas and coal bed methane. So the tables have turned. The U.S. has a lot of natural gas, David, and the demand for it overseas is growing.
What about concerns about energy independence? Why would we want to export this stuff?
Well, from a business standpoint, prices for natural gas here in the U.S. are really low, at a decade low, and across the Atlantic, they're really high. Europe gets most of its natural gas from Russia through pipelines, and the U.S. is on track to overtake Russia as the world's biggest producer of natural gas.
But there are downsides, right?
We've mentioned two of them, David. Energy independence is one, and also the techniques companies use to extract natural gas is another. But there are economic concerns as well about exporting liquefied natural gas. Sue Tierney is with the Analysis Group in Boston.
It also will have implications for gas markets in the U.S. because it would tend to raise the price of gas in the U.S. if that were to happen.
So no doubt ExxonMobil will be weighing all these factors. The company would have to secure export licenses from the government, and building plants that can liquefy natural gas, David, is very expensive.
Marketplace's David Gura in Washington. Thank you.
Thanks.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Russia's President Putin is in China today, where the two countries' shared positions on Syria will likely get the headlines. But there will be much talk about trade between the countries, which swelled to $84 billion last year. Russia is especially vulnerable when the economies of both Europe and or China slow down. Peter Van Dyke joins us from Moscow to talk about Putin's meeting. Peter, good morning.
Good morning, David.
Russia clearly has lots of oil and natural gas. China needs this type of energy to grow. Is that a focus of the talks?
That is definitely one of the focuses of the talks, but not just energy, because, of course, Russia wants to modernize its economy, and it doesn't just want to be a raw material exporter. So we are expecting some deals to be announced, including perhaps an investment vehicle worth about $2 billion set up by the two countries' state investment funds, and also possibly the announcement that they will form a joint venture to create a new long-haul airliner to rival Boeing and Airbus.
But there were reports of maybe some kind of deal involving Russian natural gas.
That's right. That is something that the two sides have been haggling over for a long time. And unfortunately for Russia, it seems they're going to continue haggling, because what we're hearing is there won't be an announcement. China doesn't want to pay the price that Russia wants it to pay. And by now, it looks like, according to Mikhail Krutikin of Rus Energy Consultancy here in Moscow, that a deal on this may never be done.
The Chinese do not need Russian gas. They are satisfying their own demand.
And they're satisfying their own demand by increasing their own domestic production through the techniques that we've seen in the US. And because China is so economically powerful, it can strike these deals with other countries. And its economic might is something that concerns Russia.
Peter Van Dyke in Moscow. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, David.
Today in San Jose, California, voters will decide whether to adopt limits on the costs of pensions for city employees. As Peter John Shuler reports from station KQED, local governments around the country are keeping a close eye on the outcome.
San Jose Mayor Chuck Reed has been pushing pension reform for months. He says retirement costs have tripled in the last decade,
which have driven us to cut services year after year. We're draining money out of services and pouring into retirements.
The measure would require workers to pay more into their retirement funds or opt into a less generous plan. But city employees say they'd rather negotiate a solution than decide it at the ballot box. 54-year-old Cheryl Wessling says the measure has already taken a serious toll on morale.
Perhaps I'd have to look at either a second job, or I'd have to consider finding a job that pays better.
Cities across California face the same pension problems. Experts say if the San Jose measure passes, other cities are likely to follow suit. I'm Peter John Shuler for Marketplace.
The big video gaming conference known as E3 is happening this week in Los Angeles. And the big question for some people there is whether the big three game console makers, we're talking Nintendo, Microsoft, Sony, can hold on to gamers in a mobile world. Marketplace's Queena Kim reports.
Wii, Xbox, and PlayStation were once the stars of the video gaming industry. Now they're the aging stars. Brian Blau is a gaming analyst at Gartner.
Their consoles are now 5 and 6 years old.
And sales have slipped as customers hold out for new models.
The industry is collectively holding their breath to see what's coming next.
Today, Nintendo will formally unveil its new Wii gamepad, but some details have trickled out. The gamepad has a second screen and a social network feature. The Wii has been hit harder than Microsoft's Xbox and Sony's PlayStation because it caters to families and casual gamers. The same players who are attracted to mobile games like Angry Birds and social games like Zynga's Farmville. Scott Steinberg is an analyst at Tech Savvy.
You can now get thousands of games free online via Facebook.
Microsoft and Sony are also battling for gamers as mobile games get more sophisticated, but there's no word on when they'll unveil their new consoles. In San Francisco, I'm Queena Kim for Marketplace.
David, have you ever seen the Great Barrier Reef down under?
Not in person.
Not in person. I saw it a few years ago, and it was one of the coolest things I've ever seen. And I was swimming down there with the sharks and stuff. Well, the United Nations World Heritage Organization, UNESCO, says now that the reef may soon be on its endangered list. That's if Australia doesn't control its industrial development in the next 8 months. Stuart Cohen reports now from Sydney.
UNESCO says it's worried about plans to greatly expand coal and gas mining, with thousands more ships carrying that cargo to China. Environmentalists like Larissa Waters of Australia's Green Party call the report a slap in the face for the country.
They've recommended that there be no new ports, that our reef not be turned into a coal and gas highway, but that it actually be protected and treated like a World Heritage icon.
But Campbell Newman, the new conservative premier for the state that's home to the reef, says protecting it shouldn't be more important than protecting people.
I say to my fellow Queenslanders, we are in the coal business. If you want decent hospitals and schools and police on the beat, we all need to understand that. We will protect the environment, but we're not going to see the economic future of Queensland shut down.
If Australia can't meet the February deadline, the Great Barrier Reef could join 35 other World Heritage sites on the endangered list, like religious sites in Afghanistan ravaged by the Taliban. In Sydney, I'm Stuart Cohen for Marketplace.
Disney is reportedly about to limit junk food ads on its radio and TV networks, including ABC and the Disney Channel. The Wall Street Journal says Disney Chairman Robert Iger is delivering the pledge today, alongside First Lady Michelle Obama, who's campaigned for healthier eating. In a completely unrelated story today, Jeremy, the fast food company Taco Bell says its new taco, made out of nacho-flavored Doritos, has become its biggest product launch in 50 years, in a half century. 100 million sold in just the first 10 weeks. If you are a residual Sex and the City fan, you may have just missed your best chance to hang with actress Sarah Jessica Parker.
President Obama and Michelle are coming to my house for dinner on June 14th, and I want you to be there too.
Last night was the deadline for entering to win a seat at that table. The cost of entering the sweepstakes, a $3 donation to Barack Obama's reelection campaign. $3 also is how much it costs to vie for a seat at George Clooney's recent Obama fundraiser and Donald Trump's recent bash for Mitt Romney. So what's with the $3 specifically? Marketplace's Chrissy Clark reports.
In most places, $3 won't even get you a gallon of gas. A cup of coffee, maybe. So why is three the number both campaigns have seized on in so many of their recent asks? Here's Casey Barr's theory.
You can barely buy anything with $3, so you're not going to miss it.
Barr should know. A few weeks ago, he got an email asking him to donate $3 for the chance to grab a bite with Mitt, and went for it. He's only 18 and had never donated to a campaign before, but heck, he'd just spent $3 on
an iced tea at Chick-fil-A. I said, why not?
That's exactly the response campaigns are hoping for, says Adam Bonica. He teaches political science at Stanford and says lots of small donors looks better than just a few big rich ones. Plus,
the more people you get to donate to your campaign, even if you're not making a large profit off of them, the more people you have vested in the campaign.
Still, what's so special about $3? Why not one or four? The Obama and Romney campaigns didn't return my calls, but the Center for Responsive Politics' Bob Biersack doesn't think the three is random. He says Obama's campaign in particular has mountains of data from the last election.
About how people responded to their request for small contributions. Maybe $3 looked magical somehow.
Of course, both campaigns will always take more. In fact, when you click on the link that says donate, $3 isn't actually an immediate option. The minimum donation for Obama is $15, Romney $10. If you look hard, you can find a button for other amount to fill in the $3 yourself. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
If you look at the stats in the U.S., 8 out of 10 people own a car, even with insurance, registration, gasoline. Americans somehow manage these costs, at least most of them. The same cannot be said in other parts of the world, including Singapore.
In the Asian city-state, a car costs as much, if not more, than a house. Joining us for our Midday Extra is the BBC's Mariko Oi in Singapore. Good morning.
Good morning.
So it costs more to have a car than a house in Singapore?
That's right. Surprisingly so, it might be. But because basically here in Singapore, you need a permit to own a car. And the price of the permit is decided by the auction. So the more people who want to drive, the more expensive it gets. I guess it's a way by the government to control pollution and traffic jam here in Singapore. But because the population has been increasing, so has the number of the cars. So the price of those permit has gone from just about 8,500 Singapore dollars 3 years ago to nearly $87,000.
And I gather that's around 67,000 US dollars.
That's correct. That's correct.
So Mariko, this is just for the permit to drive the car. You don't even have the car yet.
That's right. That's right. I actually remember a friend who wanted to buy a Mini. And if you want to buy a brand new one here, at the moment, it can cost up to 100,000 US dollars just to buy that. And my friend decided that, I got that for a few thousand dollars in the UK, so I wouldn't bother with it here in Singapore. But that's the kind of price that you are talking about here in Singapore. And interestingly, though, there are many rich people who can afford it. So you do see a very expensive million-dollar Ferrari and very expensive cars in the city state. But that also means that it makes it rather impossible for ordinary people who don't earn that much money to buy a car here as well.
So you're not seeing any beat-up old lemons driving around the streets of Singapore?
I guess not. I mean, quite a few people do go for second-hand cars because you can actually buy a second-hand permit as well, which is slightly cheaper.
Mariko, what do you do to get around in Singapore?
I catch a bus and a train. I can't really afford to have a car. So I have to catch public transport, which I must say is very efficient. So the government does have a way of making people wanting to use public transport instead of buying cars, because, as you know, Singapore is a very small place with more than 5 million people, and the population has been increasing. So it is a way for the government to try to control the number of cars on the street as well.
Mariko Oi in Singapore. She's with the BBC. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And finally, travel guidebooks can be helpful when you're heading to another country. And The Atlantic magazine has gone through some guides to see what they tell foreign visitors about us here in the United States. Wiki Travel, David, warns that when you're invited to a meal in a private home in the U.S., it's considered polite for a guest to ask if they can bring anything, of course, right? That makes sense. And the host, it says, will usually say no, you don't need to bring anything. But in fact, you should bring something. It's considered good manners, Wiki Travel says, to bring along a small gift like wine or flowers. All makes sense.
It all makes complete sense. And never, ever, ever actually show up right on time.
That's right.
For the dinner event.
It says you can get there up to 15 minutes late. But what it does say is gifts of cash or toiletries are not appropriate for a dinner party, which is pretty good advice.
Have some Kleenex.
That's right. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio. This is the Marketplace Midday Update. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.